Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. My name is Dirk-Jan Geuzendam, which for understandable reasons is often shortened to DJ. In the New in Chess podcast, we speak to leading grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory chess boards. DGT clocks and boards are used in major and minor competitions all around the world. Today, my guest is Atle Grøn. Atle is professor of Slavic linguistics at the University of Oslo, but he's also a chess grandmaster, and he's written several books on chess. In Norway, Atle is a familiar face on television as chess expert in the live broadcasts of big chess events. We've invited Atle to speak about his latest book, Games and Goals, the Fascinating Chess and Football Careers of Simen Agdestein. The book originally appeared in Norwegian and has now been published in an English translation by New in Chess. It's a biography of Simen Agdestein, who not only was the greatest Norwegian chess player before Magnus Carlsen appeared on the scene, but who also, and this is quite spectacular, had a football career. As a chess player, Agdestein won the Norwegian championship 9 times, and as a footballer, he played for the Norwegian national team 8 times. Atle, good day. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation. Very nice being here. Since this is a chess podcast, I should maybe say that I'm not a grandmaster, but an international master, for the record.
All right.
But yeah, but it happens quite often in the Norwegian press that they call me a grandmaster, so I'm used to that.
I'm just copying the Norwegian press. So thank you for accepting the invitation, Atle, and also congratulations on the book, and thank you for writing it, because Simen Agdestein is a chess player that I've always followed with a particular interest. A unique player with an independent style, an independent mind, one would say. You've known him for many years. When did the idea of the book arise?
Well, the idea first came to me in 2019, 5 years ago. And I kind of looked for a new project. I had written 2 chess books already, and for the general Norwegian market. And I thought that the chess biography was an interesting genre. And of course, for me, Simen was the ideal topic for such a book. So, but it happened quite. I didn't expect it, but Simen. Someday he approached me and said that he had written something. He had written some kind of memoirs, a manuscript, which he asked if I wanted to see it. And I said, sure, send it to me. And I immediately understood that this was not something you could publish. But at the same time, I saw that there was a lot of material here that I could use for a proper book. And then I started to work on it 5 years ago, and actually spent 4 years on the project before I published the Norwegian edition. So it took me quite some time.
But when he approached you, did he know that you were thinking of the book independently?
No, but I think that he wanted my advice. What can I do with how can I sum up my life? And I think he wanted me to write a book about him, so, and I wanted to write a book about him as well, so it was a perfect match.
Yeah. So what was his involvement?
Well, I mean, yeah, he was so we are very close friends. So we weren't friends in the old days, in the 80s. We knew each other, but we weren't friends, but now we're close friends. And in my writing periods, I could talk to him on a daily basis on the telephone, and we would also meet quite often. And he read the manuscript several times. Sometimes he read it a bit sloppily, which is typical Simen style. But in the end, he surprised me because when the final deadline was approaching, he read the manuscript very meticulously. And so I think content-wise, we are very close to the truth. I mean, we corrected all the mistakes. And so his involvement was indeed quite big. At the same time, there was this mutual trust between us, which was very nice, because he was very confident that I made the right decisions concerning what should be in the book, what should not be in the book, how one should write it. And he was also so sincere with me. and he was open to any suggestions, and he had no problems talking about his inner thoughts, his deeper emotions, and his personal problems. So what have you? So it was a really nice cooperation and a unique cooperation in that sense.
I guess that your original plan, that it came from admiration and curiosity, and that curiosity was really well fed when you started to work with him, and you must have discovered things that you had no idea about.
Yeah. So the really funny and unexpected thing was that quite early in the project, he said to me that. In my childhood home back in Asker, I have a dozen of big boxes with some kind of archive with my old chess score sheets and newspaper clippings. Do you want to see them? And I said, sure. And he came with all these boxes, and I had them in my office at the university. But what Simon had forgotten was that in these boxes, I would also find his diaries and his personal letters, even his love letters. And so that was a complete trust from him, from his side, that he gave me all the boxes without knowing the content of the boxes. For me, that was really a treasure, because then I could do what I wanted to do the most, namely to go into the psychology of the protagonist and really understand what he was thinking at that time in the 1980s through his diaries. And these diaries felt much more authentic than his thoughts today about what was going on in the 80s.
Yeah, I thought that was absolutely wonderful and a true treasure trove, as you say. Immediately, the first quote that you have in the book, when he thinks about his potential as a chess player, that is amazing to have that kind of sources.
Yeah.
I mean, can you say something about that? That his self-confidence or the trust in his capacities that he had.
Yeah. So he wrote his diaries when he was. It started when he was 18, 19, and then he wrote these notes for a period of 2-3 years. But this was when he was at his best, and he wrote these notes only to himself. So he was completely sincere, and he stated things like, I'm sure I can be the world champion. I know I have the talent. I just don't have to pay attention to what all these other people are telling me. I have the talent. I can be the world champion. It's only up to me. And at the same time, he could write about also about his doubts as a chess player. Should he choose football? Should he choose chess? Or should he choose a third way in life? So this is also very interesting, that you get to know what I would call the existential dimension of being a chess player, which we all know from personal experience. We all remember what it was like being alone at the hotel room in the 1980s with an adjournment and no computer, no mobile phone, only your own thoughts. And this is what I wanted to describe in the book. And I immediately got access to these thoughts from Simon, because normally when he would write in his diary, that was precisely in the hotel room during a chess tournament, when he had nothing else to do, right?
And quite often it is shocking. I mean, the loneliness, the wish to go home, the wish not to be there, that while at the same time, I mean, you're playing a chess tournament, you're living your dream.
Yeah. But I think this is very recognizable for chess players. And so in that sense, Simon is also a typical chess player, because especially after losing, you will get this almost existential crisis in your hotel room, because what's the point of this? There is no meaning to this. Or when you're winning, you can get the opposite feeling. These emotions are very interesting, because then you can, through his diaries and through this psychological portrait, you, at least my feeling is that I get to know Simon almost like you get to know a fictional character in a novel, because in fiction the writer will try to give this psychological portrait. In sports, it's much more difficult because you don't have access to the protagonist's thoughts, except in this case, I do actually have access to his thoughts.
Yeah.
So that was quite unique.
Well, these notes, they are very personal, as you said, and, well, revealing. Were there notes that you used where, well, in second thought, he said, well, maybe better leave this out?
No, and this was the complete mutual trust between us. So he never objected to anything. There were certainly things there that I didn't include in the book, but I would say luckily, because he had forgotten about the notes himself. Luckily, the notes were quite decent. I mean, it could they could have been worse, right?
Yeah.
So there were no really offensive details there, so the content was quite decent. But actually, during the process of writing the book, I had so much material that I could easily write 800 pages, and in the end, I ended up with 250 pages. So I thought my job was also to cut my darlings, to shorten the manuscript, and for every sentence I left in the book, I deleted two, right? Because I had so much material, especially from these boxes.
So how did you shift? What decisions did you have to take?
I tried to think about the reader. So is this enough for the reader to really know the personality of Simon, or do I need to include more? And it was a lot about structuring also the material. Where does it fit? Because a bit unlike the typical chess biography, I try not necessarily to be chronological all the time, right? So I put the quotes where they fit for the story. My main purpose is for the reader to get to know Simon, to understand Simon. And understand his unique story, but also his unique personality. And sure, I could only include a fraction of what I found, but I think in the end, it's very representative of his personality.
Yes. Well, you're a close friend of Simon. I've known him for many years. The same thing probably doesn't go for all of our listeners. How would you introduce them, Simon, to them? I mean, what was his role in Norwegian chess? What should they know about him if they don't know him?
I think what is important, especially for an international audience, it is a bit more clearer for us in Norwegian chess, is that there are two different Simon Agdesteins. There is a Simon which we know today, often through Magnus, and because he's sometimes acts as a commentator. But there's this Simon in the 1980s, which is a completely different person. And the Simon
when he was an active player himself.
Yeah, and when he was close to the world elite, when he played Kasparov and Karpov, and when he also was a great footballer, because the Simon in the 1980s was, for me and for Norwegian chess, he was, of course, a big hero, but he was also a mythical character. And I think the Simon today is not a myth. I mean, he's so open and talks to everyone, and he doesn't have this mythical side to him, which he had in the 1980s, because in the 1980s, he was almost impossible to approach for people like me, although I played in the same club as him, and I've been playing in the same club as him for more than 40 years.
But he was some sort of a sphinx with a mystery inside and all this talent.
And we thought, we maybe thought of that as arrogance, because the typical scene would be that he would come to the club, win his game, and then leave the club without talking to us. But when you get to know him now through the book and through the diaries, you understand that this is also about shyness and about him trying to find his place. And he was definitely not comfortable with being a celebrity. And unlike all the other chess players in Scandinavia at that time, he was a celebrity. He was invited to the biggest talk shows on television. So, but he was not comfortable with these things, and therefore he remained a very strange character for me and in Norwegian chess at that time. But of course, the main thing for us was that we looked upon him as a chess genius. We thought he could, if not become the world champion, at least top three in the world after Kasparov and Karpov.
Yeah, but he was so withdrawn into himself. I remember first meeting him. I mean, you write about his father, a dominant character, and at the same time a very social person, but he was a force within the family, and you could see some resistance from Seaman against that. I remember meeting his father, Ryder, when he played in Tilburg for the first time, Seaman, and I thought his father was a very nice man. He gave me some stories about what kind of a boy Seaman was, that he was an independent thinker. For instance, as a kid, he had seen his mother do the laundry, so he also put some clothes in the washing machine, and he knew that he had to add some white powder, but he added fertilizer instead of washing powder. And he also told me a story about the rivalry. His older brother, he was a great athlete, and on a New Year's Day, they were going to see an uncle, and it was 28 kilometers, and they decided to run. And then the older brother, he was the runner, but then 5 kilometers from the house of the uncle, Seaman tried to break away, and the older, and he gave that as an example of his fighting spirit, and I thought it was very telling. But when I referred to that, when I spoke to Seaman, he was very annoyed because he didn't want to hear those stories.
Yeah, that's typical of Seaman, at least typical of Seaman in those days, back in those days, because he, as you said, Seaman's father was a very charismatic figure, and I knew him very well because he used to be in our chess club almost on a daily basis, and he could sit there playing blitz the whole night long. And our chess club in Oslo was open 7 days a week.
Really?
And so it was really a meeting place for Norwegian chess before the internet, and a very important meeting place. And this is where I grew up. This is where Seaman grew up. But Seaman was already a celebrity when he came to the club, so it was a bit special. But Seaman's father was an amateur, and he loved chess, and everybody loved him because he was so charismatic and with all these good stories. But it's true that Seaman's view of his father is more complex, as you said, and it's typical that Seaman didn't like these stories which were told about him, because Seaman, as a very independent person, at least in those days, he wanted to have full control of everything. So he objected to everyone telling stories about him. And there is this, I remember there was this radio commercial which used Seaman's name, but they used it not as Agdestein, but they kind of made fun of it and said Bogdastein, like Bogolyubov and Agdestein, then Bogdastein. It was just for fun, and everybody thought it was funny. But Seaman actually sued the radio company.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because he did not accept that anyone used his name or talked about him or made up stories about him. So, and that was part of his I think it's part of his shyness also. And his personal problems and doubts about his existential doubts. So who am I? And he didn't like that everybody perceived him as a star. In the end, what he wanted was to become an average man, a normal man. And this is very, I think this is very fascinating and interesting, and it's a bit hard to understand, because normally you would think that Seaman had everything. He was best at chess, best at football. I mean, this would be a dream for everybody, right?
Yeah.
But himself, he had a lot of struggles. He was fighting, and to get also to this liberation from his father was also part of this, and mm-hmm. it was important for him. So it's a very complex psychological story.
And is that also the reason why he felt so much at ease with Knut-Göran Helmers, his first real trainer?
Knut-Göran Helmers was his definitely his first, or maybe his only real trainer. Yeah,
he and didn't a very have any typical person.
Yeah, and I wrote about him also for New in Chess for an article, and he was quite some character. He was also my trainer. Mm-hmm. So I knew him well. He was quite some character. He was the opposite of Simon in many respects, because he had this deep theoretical knowledge, while Simon was more a practical player. So the match was in that sense perfect. And in the beginning also, I would say that the cooperation was very successful. Mm-hmm. And they liked each other in the sense that Simon for the first time met a person who had some knowledge that he didn't have himself. And Helmers was not afraid of criticizing Simon. And I think Simon actually liked the fact that Helmers was so sincere and also ready to criticize him. So Simon was fed up being admired. He wanted this tough resistance from Helmers. But of course, Helmers was also a very difficult person to work with, and Helmers became extremely critical of Simon when Simon was so successful playing football, because Helmers really wanted Simon to fulfill his own ambitions and dreams and become a world-leading chess player. So in the end, the cooperation ended. But it was a very interesting. Interesting duo, and Helmers was a very important figure.
But at the same time, that was almost shocking, the way he turned against him in writing that he should fully dedicate himself to chess and stop this football nonsense. Was that a thought that was shared with others as well?
Yeah, so this is, I mean, Norwegian chess was a very small community, at least compared to the football community. Mm. But even if we compare Norwegian chess to Swedish chess or Danish chess, we were very small. So for instance, we didn't have Bent Larsen like in Denmark. Mm-hmm. We didn't have Ulf Andersson like in Sweden. Even compared to Icelandic chess, we were small. Mm. But we had Simon, and Simon was all we had. And we wanted so desperately to fulfill our dreams through Simon. So we were so desperate to see Simon succeeding at the chessboard that also myself, I was really annoyed with this football thing.
Uh-huh.
Because we understood that, okay, he's good at football, but he will not be the world top five in football, right?
Yeah.
But he can be it in chess. So can he please stop playing football? So I kind of understood Helmers' reaction, but of course Helmers went too far, because Helmers' criticism, he made it also public.
Yeah,
and he wrote things like it is a lack of morality on the part of Simon that he continues to play football and things like that. Yeah. So Helmers then put so much pressure on Simon that what it led to was that Simon played maybe less and less chess, right? Because he felt the pressure also from the chess community.
Well, sometimes he wasn't playing for months, and then
So in his best years, in 1989, for instance, which was he was at his peak chess wise in 1989, but he didn't play a single rated game until July. So the first 6 months he didn't play a single rated games. And he didn't play on the internet because there was no internet, so he didn't play chess for 6 months. That was very frustrating. Especially
if you think that then he goes to win the Nordic Championship and he goes to play Tilburg, which was the strongest tournament in the world. I mean, what kind of preparation is that?
Yeah, that's quite extreme, because Simon wrote to himself that he could be the world champion if he only trains 50% of the others, right? But in the in practice, he only trained 10% of the others. And so when he played in Tilburg, he I think it was in Tilburg that he won against Ljubojevic in the first round, I think. And that was only 10 days after he played for the Norwegian national football team against France.
Mm-hmm.
But it's as you said, he also became Nordic champion in chess in August. So he had some preparation through just playing the Nordic Championship. And in fact, he also won the Norwegian Championship in July. But that was, he won the Norwegian Championship completely unprepared. And when I looked at the games now, he was playing really badly, but the opposition was so bad that he just won it anyway. In the Nordic Championship, he played very well, actually, because then he had this training from the Norwegian Championship. And then in Tilburg, he was okay, and he met there Kasparov for the first time.
Yeah. Because that was something that struck me. And in fact, what I found fascinating is following him in tournaments where you can see that his preparation is just lousy.
Mm.
And he gets out of the opening with a dubious position. And then he digs in.
Yeah.
And then he starts to fight.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how long it will take.
Yeah.
So what is your overall view on that? That you think, would he have been a better player, or would he have achieved more had he worked harder, or is this just part of the story?
Yeah, it's a bit hard to say, because Simon could never be a very academic chess player, right? He could never he would never study chess like Kramnik or Anand. So this is what I call the Norwegian chess school, and we see it also in Magnus.
Mm-hmm.
So Magnus and Simon have this common chess philosophy, which is that you should decide the game at the board.
Yeah.
Of course, Magnus is much better prepared than Simon, but Magnus is also not afraid of being surprised in the opening, because he says to himself that I will figure it out at the board, and mm-hmm. this was also Simon's approach, that chess is a sport. And it should be decided on the board.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, Simon had no choice, because he was basically so badly prepared that he really had to resolve all these problems at the board. Yeah. And so he did.
Do you think that was the influence that he had on Magnus? That when he started to work with him, the first serious coach, and he gave him an awful lot of freedom. He always thought that, just follow your own course, because that was the way he used to be himself. I mean, how do you see that, let's say, the way they worked together and what influence he had on Magnus?
Yeah, I think he had a lot of influence on the general approach to the game, on the philosophy of the game. Not so much on the playing style, because they are very different. So Simon is a calculator. Magnus is much more intuitive and also much more universal. There are many kinds of positions that Simon couldn't play because he finds them disgusting. But Magnus can play everything. But when it comes to approaching the game as a sport, they are very similar. And Magnus learned a lot from Simon. So one thing is that you learn more if you have fun. Right?
Mm-hmm.
This is also the Norwegian chess school. And also an important advice from Simon is that you should not be afraid of playing things you don't know, because then you learn new things.
Mm-hmm.
So Simon very early gave the advice to Magnus that if you have played an opening three times, and even if you have won all your games, then find a new opening, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're not here to repeat old successes. We want to achieve new successes in new territories. So this was a very important advice. And this is what you see all the time with Magnus, that he is really not afraid of being unprepared, and he's really not afraid of just playing completely new stuff all the time. And this is part of the success.
Yeah. Well, and the interesting thing is that Magnus is probably more fanatic about football than Simon.
Yeah, Simon was actually never very fanatic about football. Mm. That's true. And you mentioned his older brother, Sjur, who was one of the best runners in Norway at 1500 meters. Mm-hmm. And Simon's physical talent was also very much related to running. Mm-hmm. So he was in Norwegian football and also probably in European football. He was, but at least in Norwegian football, he was by far the best runner. Mm-hmm. So he was the only one in Norwegian football who could run 800 meters in 1 minute 50 seconds, which mm-hmm. is extremely fast. And this was his success as a footballer. It's largely due to the fact that he was such a good runner, and also that he was quite strong. So he had this quite unique football style. It was not based on technique, but it was brute force and very efficient. And actually, some of the Norwegian football experts from that time, they compare him to Haaland in Manchester City, who is also extremely fast, extremely strong and efficient, but he doesn't have the technique of Messi, for instance, right?
Yeah. Oh, that's what you described, that very often he would be late for the ball, but then get it anyway because of this, well, this strength and the his athletic talent.
Yeah, which was really unique. I talked to the legendary Norwegian coach Egil Olsen, who actually, when he was a coach for the national team, he took us to the second place on the FIFA ranking, and we beat Brazil in the World Cup in 1998. Mm. That was after Simon's football career. But he was also Simon's coach, and he said that, he had never seen any footballer like Simon. Mm-hmm. Because he was a fighter also on the football pitch, like he was at the chessboard. So he was... Simon is, in that sense, quite a unique sportsman. He is really a fighter and not a technician or a theoretician, mm-hmm. but a fighter.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. With the DGT electronic chessboard, millions of chess lovers can follow chess tournaments live. At home, chess fans use the boards to play online or play against chess computers with the same boards that top players use in tournaments all over the world. Play like a pro with a DGT board.
So what is his legacy in Norwegian football? I mean, how many people clearly remember him? How much footage is there of him playing?
Yeah, there's maybe not so much footage actually, but the when he scored for the national team against Czechoslovakia in 88, then we have footage of that, and also there must be some footage of the matches. But I think in Norway, everybody knows about this unique combination of football and chess, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody of my generation, I mean, well, of course, the younger people maybe don't know, but this is part of if you were a Norwegian in the Norwegian society in the 1980s, you would remember Simon as a footballer, no doubt about it.
Because it makes such a difference. I mean, just hearing the stories or seeing the photos, seeing the
it's actually his goal against Czechoslovakia is actually really nice. Okay. So I'm glad we have it because it shows that he could actually also handle the ball. I mean, there was this myth that which maybe I'm responsible for because I wrote something about Simon's technique on the football pitch, which was not very flattering, but when I see his goal against Czechoslovakia and see he was quite good also with the ball after all.
Well, what I do remember is by some strange coincidence, I saw his when he played against Italy with Norway in Bari or
in 88.
Yeah, it was on television.
Uh huh.
And I remember the commentator while waxing lyrical and Arc de Stein, and that was in Italian. Yeah. I mean, so that exists.
Oh, you saw it. Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Yeah, because he played in October 88, his first match for the national team was against Italy. And Italy had then Baresi, Maldini, Vialli.
Yeah.
And several of the Italian players had become world champions in 82.
Yeah.
This was only 6 years after 82. Mm. So it's quite extraordinary. And Simon said... Simon says in the book that Baresi and Maldini, they were quite kind of afraid of him.
Yeah.
Afraid because he was because of his physique.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's no chance that there will be a film about him as a football player. There's probably not enough material there, or
no, I don't think so. So because he was a football player just before our first success with the national team when we beat Brazil and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because he got the injury before the start of the Norwegian football boom. And then these days, I wouldn't say that Norway is very good at football, but at least we have some stars like Haaland, which we didn't have then. So... Mm. He was a footballer.
But in fact, his technique is very efficient, isn't it?
Yeah, Haaland's technique is very efficient, but Haaland also misses quite a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is Simon says this, the same about himself, that he got so many chances because of his physique and because of his fighting abilities, and then of course he scored a lot of goals, but he also missed a lot, right?
This is
what you see with Haaland also. He scores a lot, but of course, he misses quite a few chances as well.
So when Simon got injured, his knee injury that essentially ended his football career, how dramatic was that for him? I mean, what effect did that have on his life?
Oh, that was really dramatic in all respects, because of course we, as chess players, we the kind of hope that this would mean that he would now become a full-time chess player. But he became depressed and he got all these physical problems, but which eventually also gave him a lot of psychological problems. And this crisis, which we were not really aware of how bad it was, but the crisis lasted for many years. So it started, the injuries started like in 91, and then he gave up his football career in 92, 93. But I would say that his life crisis lasted for quite some years, and you could say that it ended when he discovered Magnus in January 2000. Mm-hmm. So 7-8 years later, at least that was a highlight and it was the beginning of something completely new.
Mm-hmm.
But the end of the 90s were terrible for Simon.
Mm-hmm. So you see a special significance there, his discovery of Magnus and the joy that he got from working with him.
Yeah, because he had just in 98, he had founded his chess academy at the Norwegian Gymnasium for Sports. But the pupils were, he liked his pupils and they are decent human beings, but they were not particularly strong chess players, right?
Mm.
And then he discovered Magnus in January 2000 when Magnus was only 9 years old. And interestingly, Magnus was not very good for his age,
mm-hmm.
but Simon saw the potential.
Yeah.
And he saw that he had never seen anything similar when it comes to potential.
Mm-hmm.
So in the first game Simon saw when Magnus played, Magnus blundered a rook and didn't manage to win a completely winning position.
Yeah.
But Simon said to Magnus' father that I can turn him into a world champion, right? And
mm-hmm.
He asked Simon's father, where do you live?
Mm-hmm.
And it happened that they lived only some 15 minutes from his chess academy, right?
Yeah.
So it was a perfect match in that sense, and a very lucky coincidence that that they met in this way, and that Simon discovered Magnus in that way.
Yeah, well, that's one of the nice things in the book, that you can see that so many of these people, they're all interlinked, and well, the role of the Asgard Chess Club, well, that you were also a member of, is that coincidence? I mean, or just luck?
Yeah, there. Part of this is luck, of course. So, yeah, it turned out that Henrik Carlsen, Magnus' father, was actually played Simon in Asker Chess Club when Simon was young. But Simon didn't remember that. But Henrik remembered it, and yeah. Henrik told me about it. So it turned out that Henrik was member of the same club as Simon and Espen. Yeah, so that was... well, there are a lot of factors there, a lot of coincidences, a lot of luck, of course. But I think that you can say that you wouldn't have Simon Agdestein if you didn't have his father, his brother Espen, with whom he could play Blitz all day long.
Who became the manager of Magnus Carlsen.
Yeah, and you wouldn't have Simon if you didn't have Arnold Eikrem, who organized all these tournaments at Gausdal.
Yeah.
But you could also say that you wouldn't have Magnus if you didn't have Simon and all these other factors. Well, Simon is only one factor in Magnus' life, but he was the first one to see the potential. And Simon had the advantage that he knew, he wasn't afraid of thinking big. He wasn't afraid of the thought that why shouldn't Magnus become the world champion? Because he had similar thoughts himself, right?
When he was sitting opposite Spassky.
Yeah, when he was only 16 and he beat Spassky. But it's very hard for people like me and other people in the chess community to think that big, to see that, okay, Magnus has the potential of becoming a world champion, even when Magnus' own rating was 900, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember when I first heard about this, heard these things about Magnus, I was really skeptical. I remember I said to my fellow chess friends that, oh, look, we have Karjakin, who is so much better. I mean, okay, maybe Magnus can be top 10, but come on, relax now, right? But Simon all the way believed that this was possible, just as he believed that he himself could have become one of the best.
Yeah. Well, I just remember that when I asked him about this story of this 28-kilometer run with his brother, then Simon said, well, it was not that I wanted to beat him, but it was just a challenge that I liked. Yeah. And when you said, well, there was this early Simon, there was the later Simon, but in fact, these challenges, they always kept appealing to him, like when he was dancing with the stars, on television, and he thoroughly enjoyed that, or when you suddenly see him in a pop concert with singing with a hip hopper or whatever. I mean, that's all also Simon.
So these later things with the Dancing with the Stars and the pop concerts, that's a later Simon, because he's not, he actually enjoys public attention now. But what is a commonality between the former Simon and the later Simon now is that his competitive ability and the fact that he can win the Norwegian Championship twice in a row as a 55-year-old and 56-year-old.
Yeah,
that is because when he's sitting there at the chessboard, he cannot help not wanting to win, and so he has this very strong competitive gene.
You think it's even more the competitiveness than his love for the game, or is it just a very potent mix?
I think it's competitiveness, because I think it's competitiveness. Of course he loves the game also, and maybe he even loves the game more now than in the 80s, because then there was quite a lot of stress and pressure, but so he loves chess, but he is a real competitor. So I just remember, so a couple of years ago, we were skiing together. And when you go skiing, cross-country skiing, we talk to each other the whole way. But when we approach the car, when we're going back, then he just made sure that he was first, right?
yeah.
So. Of course, yeah. I think it's a fascinating biography, Atle, and it's wonderful to read. And well, obviously he's a very interesting person, and with so many sides. When you started to write the book, did you think of any other, well, chess biographies or general biographies, and where you thought, okay, I shouldn't do this, or I definitely should do that? Mm. What was your starting point?
Well, yes, I have read a lot of chess books and also other biographies, and I thought that, okay, so the first thing is that I didn't want to focus too much on results and on games, at least not in a chronological order. So there is an appendix where you have the results and you have the games, but I wanted the text to be smooth. Mm-hmm. So that you can read the text and not stop all the time, because there you have all these annotations in the text, the chess annotations. So I wanted some diagrams, but I wanted the diagrams to be part of the text, part of the storyline. Mm-hmm. And therefore, in the text, I don't include games, but the games come in an appendix. And I was also thinking a lot about this, about chronology, because I think that many chess players are kind of slaves of chronological order. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to escape that, but at the same time, I realized that I need some chronology, because of course it shouldn't be confusing for the reader either, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to find the balance, and I spent a lot of time working on that. And then I tried to ask myself all the time, is this sentence really interesting for the reader? And if it's not, then you should delete it. I mean, to kill your darlings, mm-hmm, is a very important principle, which I think in general chess writers are maybe quite good, but I think it's part of many chess writers' character that they have this tendency to include too much, mm-hmm, especially when it comes to games. So when you read a chess game inside a book, it can work, but then you need a lot of diagrams. Mm-hmm. And I say to myself that if I am, after all, I'm an international master, if I cannot follow the moves in my head, then they are a bit pointless. I mean, I can see the diagrams, but if I can't follow the moves, I will not, why are the moves there? I will not get a physical board and go through the game like that, mm-hmm, right? Yeah, so, but I think that the chess biography is a very interesting genre, and you have the opposites in the biography. So you have two Dutch opposites would be Sosonko and van der Staden, mm-hmm, which I think both are actually very good. And I want to say that I want to say something about van der Staden, because I'm reading that book now, mm-hmm, his big book, thick book, which is 750 pages. But if you start with Sosonko, then I think what makes Sosonko such a great writer is that he is not afraid of breaking the chronology. Mm-hmm. He doesn't care at all, mm-hmm, about chronology. He doesn't care about results. And what I find a bit strange is that he doesn't even care about games. So mm-hmm, I think that if I were him, I would include some more diagrams after all. But he is he only cares about good stories, which is which makes it a very enjoyable read. Van der Staden's project is extremely interesting, because it's
his big book Black and White, where he very openly writes about his chess career and well, all the trauma that came with his chess career, besides the successes.
Yeah, and so normally I would not welcome such a project, because I mean, how many games are there? 500? I don't know, but a lot of games and a lot of pages. And after all, van der Staden is not Tal or Kasparov, so how can he write so much about himself? But precisely because it's such a crazy project, I really like it. I mean, it reminds me of the French writer Marcel Proust, who wrote 3,000 pages with his personal memories.
Yeah.
And this is what van der Staden does, but it's so sincere. And that makes this project quite unique, because what I miss in chess biographies is often the sincerity that that you really get to know the protagonist. Of course, van der Staden writes an autobiography, so it's obvious that that he knows what he's writing. But and then he can be so sincere. So that was my aim, to write a biography where you, as a reader, get to know the protagonist as if it were a novel. And then as a reader, you become captivated by the story, because you really feel that you know this person, right? So this is also what I'm often missing in chess biographies, that there are too many facts and
I get what you mean. Well, it's the chronology, the addiction to chronology, too many games and too few personal notes often. But are there chess biographies that you would really recommend? I mean, what would be your top three chess biographies where you say, well, that those are worth reading?
Since I've been a professor of Russian for many years, for 20 years I mostly read, or not mostly, but I read a lot of Russian stuff, and I also read Sosonko in Russian. But I think I liked some of John Donaldson's work on Fischer, because Fischer, and you've also written interesting things about Fischer. Fischer has he's a myth, right? And therefore, so Donaldson writes about very small details in Fischer's biography, but since Fischer is a myth, then every detail becomes interesting. But as a reader, I really enjoy. So Sosonko has written about Tal, or maybe what he wrote about Smyslov is better, and is more interesting, because Smyslov is more like a myth than Tal, because we know so much about Tal, but we know less about Smyslov. And there is this Russian guy Tierekhov, who has also written about Smyslov, and of course. Sosonko has also written about Bronstein, which is not everybody likes his style, because he can be very critical, and it's a very subjective way of writing, the Sosonko style. But I'm sure there are many many good books out there. So
I'm thinking out loud. Well, these are let's say biographical books, but they are not biographies. Let's say in the good old Anglo-Saxon tradition of a life in a book, which doesn't require games but just tells the story of a life. And in fact, we hardly have any of those.
No, that's true. And I some years ago I read a very good biography written by a Russian journalist, Masha Gessen, who is now in exile in the States. But she wrote about a Russian mathematician, Perelman, who is a very eccentric and extremely interesting mathematician. And he actually went to the same school, and I think even maybe the same class as Halifman in St. Petersburg, Alexander Halifman, the FIDE world champion. And that was what you say, that was a real biography without any mathematics, but it was so fascinating because you got all the details and you got both the facts and the psychological portrait. And it's true that we don't have that in chess. So even Tal, for instance, we don't have a proper biography of Tal. So the book that is most famous in English is, it says on the English cover that it's written by Tal, but it's not written by Tal, it's written by Damski. and it's translated from Russian, but it's kind of more like an interview where Damski interviews Tal, and Tal just comes with some stories and some games. Yeah. Of course, it's a good read, but it's not a biography, and you don't really get to understand these personalities through what we call chess biographies, because they are not real biographies, as you say.
Yeah. Well, probably the thing that comes closest is Frank Brady's book on Fischer. I mean, yeah, there's no games there, and yeah, it's chronological life description. Yeah. But just imagine someone like Alyokhin to have... I mean, you wouldn't need any games there. There's so much story.
Yeah. And yeah, that's true.
And it's amazing that it has never been done.
Yeah, and not for any. So there is this big project on Lasker, but it's a bit... I haven't read it, but people say it's very good. But it's, as I understand, it's a collection of articles, right?
Yeah, it's very fragmented.
Yeah, so you don't get the whole picture from one biographer who sees... Mm-hmm. Everything, yeah. Right? Yeah, I've been thinking about this because I would love to read a real biography of for instance, Tal, where you actually get into details such as his, how was his relationship really with the Soviet authorities, right? Mm. So now we have so much anecdotes and stories.
Yeah,
but they are always kind of, you don't get the real picture because Tal would always comment these things with a joke.
Yeah.
But then it's the job of the real biographer to actually give us the truth about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
well, this
it's
probably
really
hitting
lacking.
The nail on the head. That I mean, if there's too many anecdotes, then you're not there where you want to be.
Yeah. Yeah, so I would love to see a biography of Tal and these people, but when it comes to Magnus and Kasparov, I'm not so sure that the time is ripe and whether a biographer could really say something interesting, because Kasparov and Magnus, they are so sincere and open and give so many interviews, and they are not mythical characters. We know so much about them.
Yeah, well, that was what I was wondering, and which of course was going to be one of my last questions, is did you ever consider a biography of Magnus? I mean, I think it still has to be written. I mean, there have been books that have been written, I think Seaman's book on him is, for that phase of his life, is brilliant. But well, if we're talking about this biography in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, there's still room there.
Yeah, there's still room, but it's quite a challenge, precisely because he's so active on so many arenas, and he plays so much, he says so much, and I think it was easier to write about him when he was shy and when he didn't. Mm. So there was a time when Magnus didn't want public attention and avoided the press. And at that time, I enjoyed writing about him in the Norwegian chess circles. Now it's difficult.
Oh, I remember this film that was made about him, where one of the conditions of the film was that he would get a one-hour interview, which he never got.
Yeah,
I mean, that was the kind of cooperation that he got.
Yeah, and then there was some kind of mythical... side to him, but of course it goes also for Kasparov. They are amazing personalities, right?
Mm-hmm.
You really need some guts to write a biography about one of these people, two people.
Yeah, well, probably even more with Kasparov. I mean, It's if you just think about what he's already done in his life, and he's not done yet. I mean, it's so much, and so many things that in fact deserve really delving into. But well, okay. So you're still chewing on that idea of the Magnus biography. Are there any other projects you?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm not chewing on the Magnus idea. That, but. Because there is also this problem, if you want to write such a book, should you write it should you be independent and critical, or do you write it together with the Magnus team, right? And this would be two completely different approaches to such a to such a project. No, but I immensely enjoy reading and writing about chess. So I think in a couple of years I will write another chess book, right? But but in the same, not a biography, but I prefer to tell stories through text and small diagrams. Mm-hmm. That is kind of my genre. And then when I write in this way, it's also possible for people who are not strong chess players to follow the story, and that is so. I try to write for both for grandmasters and for especially in Norway. There are a lot of people who would buy such books who are not real chess players in our definition of the word.
Well, we'll see what that will lead to, Atle. For the moment, well, thank you very much for this book, which I can warmly recommend to anyone interested in chess and special persons, because there's a lot of chess in it and there's a lot of special person in there. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it very much, and I enjoyed our talk. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.